Hey, Tacoma. John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate, always respectfully, ever striving to be fact-based, open to divergent perspectives, and always actively optimistic. Today we're talking with Dick Murray. Dick is a prominent Republican in Washington State, active over the years in the state legislature. He's run for U.S. Congress, is presently the mayor of Steilacoom, and plus many years of service as an officer in the Air Force. Dick is an effective and confident spokesperson for his point of view, which in many respects is different than mine. And because of his easygoing ways, still the kind of guy I could enjoy talking politics over a beer or two. So about conservatives and climate, or more generally, the environment. According to Yale Climate Communications, in Washington State, about 85% of Democrats think government should be doing more about climate change. For Republicans, the number is half that. No surprise there, since conservatives tend to resist anything they see as increasing government impact on the economy. On the other hand, when we're talking about clean water and clean air, the gap between the two ideologies is much narrower. I think you'll see that difference playing out in our conversation today. Among his many interests, Dick Murray is an electric car aficionado. He's the organizer of the annual Drive Electric event in Steilacoom. It's going to be on September 10th this year. I'll be there with my Nissan Leaf, along with 100 or so other EV owners in this folksy and non-commercial event. It's a great afternoon out, fun for everyone, and a chance to talk to owners about their experiences with EVs. So I'd love to see you there. So with that, here we go with our conversation with Dick Murray. Dick Murray, great to have you on Climate Talk again. Thanks for joining.
It's good to be here.
So let's start right off. Our theme today is going to be about conservative approaches towards environment and climate change in general. And full disclosure here, I consider myself a liberal or a progressive. And Dick, I think it's fair to say you would consider yourself a conservative. Is that right?
That's correct. 25 years of elected experience and various, my fourth different job as an elected official. Yeah, I'm considered a conservative.
Yeah. Well, I'll just take this opportunity real quickly to thank you for your service. Over 20 years, I believe, in the U.S. Air Force, a distinguished career there. So thank you for that. So let's start right off by, I will just ask you, we live in a really tough political environment these days. And by tough, I mean, it seems like things are polarized discourse. When it happens, is not very civil sometimes. So just in your opinion, is it possible that conservatives and liberals, progressives can have constructive conversations about things like environment and climate change?
I think so. In fact, it's interesting. One of my best friends here in Steilacoom is Jim Burke, who's very involved in the environmental movement and bees and solar power and, you know, net zero and all this kind of stuff. And he's one of my best friends, and we talk all the time, and we have a great conversation. And he's one of my new committees that I put together here for the town to work on parks and environment and sustainability. And so, yeah, we love having coffee together and consider a friend. And here in the town of Steilacoom, you know, maybe because we're not big city, we're a little suburban. It's pretty congenial. You know, I'm also the mayor of this town.
Yeah.
And I'm getting good feedback from everybody. In fact, I had an election. I had a young man run against me for mayor last year, and I got 81% of the vote. And even all my Democrat friends wanted the yard signs in their yard. And he says, "We may not like your politics, but we like the way you run the town."
So. Yeah. Well, you know, there really is a lot to be said about that, because it does seem like in all of our let's talk about more at the national level, our national squabbling running the country seems to have gotten lost in the smoke somehow or other. So I think that folks can definitely respect a politician who is capable of running whatever government they're responsible for.
Yeah, we just got to tone up rhetoric and come back with the areas that we have in common. And some of the hot button issues, just avoid them. You can talk about it if you want, and then, you know, we take a vote. That's it.
So. Yeah. Well, my focus today in this conversation is understanding what you have to say as a conservative, rather than putting any of my own stuff forward. And so let's start off by saying, do you think that, let me put it this way. How would you characterize conservative concern about the environment and climate change?
Well, I think most conservatives tend to be climate change skeptics, and there's a lot of reasons for that. In fact, you know, I have a hard time changing my mind from when I went to college. I went to University of Massachusetts, a degree in environmental health.
Wow.
So I was one of the environmental health majors back when it was first. And back then it was all about the oncoming ice age and how things were getting cold and because of man's pollution and all that kind of stuff. And then about 10, 15 years later, it became, no, maybe we're not getting too cold. We're getting too warm. So, you know, I'm believing the Goldilocks thing. Maybe it's just about right. Maybe not. CO2 is rising. That's one measurement that we can say this is happening. But I tell people, you know, all the carbon that's in the world for the most part will someday be burned. We can, here in the United States, for every coal-fired plant we shut down, India or China adds a new one. A lot of people don't realize that China is 60% of the world's coal. India is 20%. So that's 80% right there. But they're each of them have 1.4 billion people. The Prime Minister of India made a good call about this idea of defossilizing, you know, carbon-based fuels. He says, we have 400 million people in India that don't even have electric power yet. So the thing about it, they have more people who don't even have electricity than we have. And they're trying to bring a basic life, and they're doing it through coal because they have lots of coal and they have a lot of people that can mine coal. And same thing with China. But China, give them credit, is also looking for sustainable energy. But they're, as much as they're adding solar and wind and all that, they're growing so rapidly they're still burning a lot of coal. But I tell people 2 out of every 3 electric cars in the world are in China.
Yeah.
And they're doing it for a different reason also, not only because they can burn coal and produce electricity, but they want to get the pollution out of the cities. They have like 20 cities that have more than 10 million people. Now, you got to think about that. They have 20 cities that have more people than we have people in all the Northwest. They have all the people of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho together.
Yeah.
About 10 million people. And they have city after city after city. So it's kind of a whole different perspective. And they're trying to attain our level of standard of living. Now, where the environmentalists in this country have really... And I think they were kind of recognizing, made 2 backward steps, preserving the environment and going to sustainability. And Elon Musk, who I've become a big fan over the last couple of years, said bluntly, we need more nuclear power. We should be shutting down nuclear power plants. We should find a way to build safe, reliable nuclear. In fact, he's chastising Germany for shutting down their nuclear plants. And now they're going to be burning more coal in Germany, of all things, next year or two. Their next door neighbor, France, 70-80% of the electricity comes from nuclear. So somehow France, which is to the west of Germany, can build all these nuclear power plants safely and Germany can't? Come on, what's going on here? But the other area where the environmentalists in the United States really need to have a look in the mirror and have a figure out what they're doing is they're not allowing mining in the United States. So they want all this, you know, lithium, then we need all this cobalt, we need nickel, we need copper. And there's mines all across, mainly in the Western United States, that have been going through a permitting process for almost a decade and they still can't get a permit. That doesn't happen in China. They got some here. This 6 months later, you're fully operational. We need to have our own mineral source. So this is what's happening to Ford and GM. And that's where Elon Musk is and Tesla's got it made. They understood supply chain. Of course, they have some supply chain issues too. But if you're going to build batteries, you got to build a battery plant. It takes years to get that done, permitted. But even then, before that, you need to get the mineral sources, you know, developed too. So the mega battery plant they have in Nevada was there for 2 reasons. Nevada, and that's where the minerals are. And he secured all the mining rights and the mining and all that kind of stuff. So the environmental movement needs to take a look and say, okay, sustainability also means batteries and batteries and minerals. They're recognized. I'm reading in the reports and they're going, yeah, maybe we've got a, you know, that copper mine in Arizona that we opened. Cobalt, 20 to 25% of our country's cobalt needs one small area in Idaho where they want to do some mining and they think they can do it safely. They're putting all the money and safety things into place.
Yep. Well, you've made several comments there that I definitely think that, let's just say we as a political entity can agree is a problem. So one of them is this permitting process that you're talking about. I'll give an example. You may be familiar with it. There's a new high tension power line was recently approved from Wyoming down into the Southwest. So a lot of wind energy up in Wyoming and a lot of people down in the Southwest. And it took them 15 years to get that permit, which is just crazy. So we absolutely have to if we're going to maintain our environment the way we want it, we have to streamline the permitting process, I think. Same thing for nuclear. I mean, I also think this is a place where people all over the spectrum need to take a hard look at nuclear and realize that it provides energy independence. It's a relatively non-polluting source of energy. And at the same time, we need to understand that there is no free ride on anything. I mean, when we mine, there's going to be effects of that. When we transport stuff, there's effects of it. So I think that we need to, as you say, take a hard look at those things rather than kind of digging into our sure. various perspectives.
Yeah, it can be done safely and responsibly, and make sure that it's done safely and responsibly with all the permits and requirements and oversight. You know, just because you get the permit doesn't mean you stop with the inspection, you know. And God we trust, but everybody else we inspect.
Yeah, so when you made a comment about pollution in China, which, as we know, especially in their large cities, is, well, I don't think deadly is too strong a word to use to refer to it. So climate change is one thing that we can talk about in terms of fossil fuels, but the pollution from fossil fuels is also a concern, as you point out, in China. So what would, go ahead. You had something you want to throw in there.
No, you're right. That's why the pollution that I worry most about here is, number one, every oil car, and I've had to tell people this, it's going to eventually leak crankcase oil, or it's going to leak from the engine and all that. I mean, you don't have to have somebody visit you with an old truck or an old car, and they leave and you got this puddle, you know, and you go, crap, you know, oil all over my driveway. And so they'll say, well, my vehicles never do that. I says, yeah, because you sell them at the 5, 10, 15 year point, but the average vehicle from the time it's manufactured to the on average before it goes to a recycler is 20 years. It's between that 15 and 20 year point where somebody, usually of lower income means, is driving that vehicle. Yeah. And they're dropping pollution all over the roads, which eventually washes into the storm drain, which eventually washes into the Puget Sound. You got the noise pollution, and then you also got the air pollution. I got a couple of my neighbors, one's related, driving diesel trucks. I don't care. You know, they might get good mileage and all that, but you know when a diesel truck's going to be in your neighborhood because it stinks. You know, and that can't, not only I don't like the smell, but it can't be good for me breathing it in. So there's a reason. In fact, that's one of the, I have a friend who just bought a Rivian. Now, I won't go into many details about it, but this is the last guy in the world I thought would buy a Rivian. He's in his 50s. He runs a tree service company. And he told me about 3 months ago, yeah, I'm going to buy a Rivian and I'll make sure I take it to your car show. And I'm going, yeah, right. and then about 2 months ago, he says, hey, I'm getting it. Want to come out test drive it with me? And I did. It was, what a beautiful vehicle. And then he just sent me a picture the other day, and he's already using it in his workplace. He's towing all these huge vehicles. And I says, aren't you worried about getting a scratch and dent? And he goes, no, it's a truck. We're worried about it getting, you know, it's a work truck, you know, so, but he's loving it.
So you made reference to diesel, and of course, diesel is a particularly nasty fuel. Maybe only bunker fuel used in marine shipping is worse. So what would you, and you also made reference to, in that particular case, you have to breathe. If there's diesel in the air, diesel fumes in the air, you got to breathe that. And there's a lot of good evidence that people that live in areas where there's more diesel trucking, that health is impacted in those places. So what would be a conservative approach to dealing with that?
Well, it's giving incentives to go to electricity, but if not in the meantime, also natural gas. It's like, in fact, this is another thing where, again, environmentalists, you know, downtown Tacoma, they try to build this LNG plant. I remember in 2013, Governor Inslee was there with a big proclamation, we're going to reduce our carbon footprint particulates by 90%. And that was because we want to use natural gas from here to Alaska and the shipping, you know, and that we can enforce that and all that. And without LNG storage, the shipping lines aren't going to build ships that require LNG. They have to fuel up. Well, now they're trying to, you know, they tried to stop that plant even while it was being built. And so critical. The LNG is critical because right now, at least for the next 40, 50 years, as a source of fuel for ships. You just can't build the batteries big enough to have a ship that can be propelled by a battery from here all the way to Alaska.
Right.
I know they're in Norway, they're building some of their ferries that they go like 10, 15 miles and, you know, on batteries, and then they come back and they charge. But we're talking about going up 2,500 miles. Size of the batteries or the amount of times you'd have to stop to charge, incredible.
So, yeah.
So maybe that might change. But right now, it's we need LNG. So.
Yeah. So I heard you use the word incentives in terms of encouraging people to use non-fossil fuel vehicles, especially things like diesel trucks. Seems like there's a flip side to that too, and that is that the oil industry gets a lot of special privileges, and around the world they get actually direct subsidies. So what would a conservative take be on the what I would see as the financial privileges that they've gained politically over the years that may give them an edge up when it's compared to other energy sources?
You know, a true conservative is against all subsidies, and so anything that goes to the oil industry needs to be eliminated a long time ago. You know, it's not right. You can't say, I'm a conservative and I believe in a free enterprise system and capitalism and all that, and then say, well, we're going to subsidize somebody because we like them better. Now, that's any of those subsidies that are there. I don't know exactly what subsidies are there, but they are there. They need to get rid of them. And I imagine that they're at the federal
level. Yeah, absolutely. They're at the federal level. And a lot of them are somewhat disguised forms of subsidies that, you know, privileges given to the oil industry that aren't given to other industries. So there's not really a fully level playing there, but they're there nevertheless. So let's just, one of the things I wonder about, and I've heard conservatives say this, that the liberal approach to climate and the environment is maybe not fully honest, that what the liberals, progressives are trying to do is use concerns about the climate and environment to enact what could be called a liberal agenda. What would be your take on that?
Well, they might be, but it doesn't matter. It's all good. Elon Musk again said that, he said, if we had a 100-year supply of oil, and if all the oil in the world was in the United States, we still need to start thinking about how we transition. Something that's going to take decades to do, both in the development of the technologies, but also the supply chains and all that. So why wouldn't we want to do something sustainable? And so I don't care what the reason is, people drive electric or use some, eventually maybe hydrogen or something else other than a fossil fuel. But that gets me also back to one of the problems with solar and wind, a few others, is how do we store power needed at peak demand? We're fortunate here in the Northwest. We have the biggest, baddest batteries in the world. That's called dams.
Right.
And I won't go into details because I got a very progressive friend who's into the power. I'm going to be on that. He says, it's a crazy idea that we're going to think about taking down the Snake River Dam. So whatever we need to do to help the salmon, we can do that. But it says that if anything, we need to be building more dams or more power generation at these dams, because the dams are great in that that's potential energy that can be then some kinetic energy. We need dams can be turned on and off. And so when the wind's not blowing and or the sun's not shining, you know, you're producing power. And in fact, I'm getting solar power on my house here in within the next 30 days. You know, the grid will take the energy, but these power managers need to be able to sustain it. So you have a surging of energy coming and going. The way we do it in the Northwest is through either natural gas, which using generators, or through the dam. And that's a big thing. So, but the interesting thing is about wind energy. We don't think about it, but you know where wind energy is taking off like crazy?
Texas.
The Midwest.
Yeah.
Texas is number one. I think Oklahoma is number two, Nebraska number three, or Kansas number four. And people say, why is that? Well, first of all, have you ever been there? <It's>, land is cheap and the wind blows almost all the time. Everybody in that station at McCord Air Force Base that flies the airlift aircraft are training bases at Altus Air Force Base in Oklahoma, southwest corner of Oklahoma. There's nothing out there. There's hardly any trees because the wind blows all the time. You know, it's a great place for growing cotton and whatever, but it's windy and sometimes tornadoes, but it's really windy. But I've heard some of these windmills, they have a payback in under 2 years.
Yeah.
ROI. So the problem with, again, wind, it blows most of the time and they can add it to the grid and all that. But what happens if the wind's not blowing and it's really hot and you need, you know?
Yeah. And unfortunately, When we have extreme weather is when we need the most electricity, either cold or hot, and wind. Those are not good times for the wind to be blowing. When it's really, really cold and really, really hot, then those windmills are not going around. Just a quick aside about the Midwest and the windmills. Of course, they're taking hold there not because of people's environmental concern. It's taking hold because it makes financial sense.
That's right.
So a farmer, a rancher can put up windmills, which their footprint is very, very small, and still have his cattle roaming the plains or whatever they do back there with this stuff. So they do make a lot of sense. But the variability, of course, is a problem. In terms of storage, by the way, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this. It's fairly new on the scene. But there's this concept of gravity storage where a facility is built where huge blocks of concrete during high energy output times like windy or sunny day, those blocks are raised, and then when you need the energy, they're lowered down. They're real, real low tech. I'll send you if you're not familiar with it, it is an intriguing concept.
That is intriguing. I'd like to have to send it to me, because that's, you know, instead of using water, we were using concrete, you know, or something like that. And you can raise it, but there's in fact, we had a briefing in our Kiwanis Club, and I think it's recorded and on our Kiwanis Club of Steilacoom website about the pump storage system they want to build down there east of Vancouver. I'm trying to think of the place where it's supposed to be, Goldendale.
Yeah.
But I think like a 2,000-foot, 60-acre pond at the base, 2,000-foot stock up to the top with another 60-acre, you know, pond. And it was going to be $1.2 billion to build this. But it would, when power was plentiful, excess, they would pump water up there. And then when all of a sudden they peak demand, think about the head of water to go in 2,000 feet. You know, some of these dams like Grand Coulee, 100 feet is like a huge amount of water.
Well, one of the things that is so attractive about that stuff is it's low tech. I mean, we know how to do this. It doesn't require a lot of research and so on. So,
one of my first field trips in college, it was my junior year, we took a field trip up to Vermont where they were doing pump storage. This was back in 1974, 1975. Yep. And it was, I remember the number 3 for 2. So every 3 units of energy they used at that time to pump the water up, they'd only get 2 back. So it was like, you know, 33% loss, probably less than that now, probably more efficient. But this was electricity that would have been wasted.
Right? Yeah.
And it was to meet demand. Yeah.
Well, there's the reasonable and thoughtful ways of getting non-fossil fuel energy is pretty long. Over in Douglas County, there is a project going on now. Of course, they've got excess hydro at sometimes they need all the hydro they've got, but they've got excess, and they're installing a hydrogen production plant there to use that excess energy when they have it to create hydrogen, which is a form of storage. And of course, hydrogen can be used to potentially for long distance ocean travel or air travel and that kind of thing. And I've gotten to know a guy named Jim Konka over he's over on the other side of the mountain someplace. And he's got a long career in energy. And one of the things he pointed out to me was that there are 1,800 dams in the United States that could be generating electricity. They just don't have generators on them. And so, you know, you don't have to build new dams. You don't have to flood new areas. So you could be making energy that way. So there's lots of possibilities out there.
Speaking of which, I just came from last week from the Association of Washington Cities Conference, and I met my old flying buddy from back in the 80s, Wade Ferris. He's now the he's a year older than me, so I'm 68. He's 69. They're 2.8 cents a kilowatt hour, and I said, "You guys got to." And he's the city manager of Chelan, and he goes, "I said, you guys need to go electric." And he goes, "You're right, and we're looking at and thinking about that." So
Well, in that regard, I mean, right here in Tacoma too. I mean, we, as you probably know, we sell off about 13%, 14%, 15% of our hydro to California every year. And we could be using that for, if we had more electric vehicles and we're electrified in other areas, we could be keeping that money at home here instead of sending it off to Houston or someplace like that.
My neighbor, who I can see his house from my house here, he's the power manager for Tacoma Power. So, but yeah. I asked him, I said, with all this rain, you know, and fairly low temperatures, how you guys producing a lot of electricity? He says, oh, yeah. We're producing a lot of electricity and we're making big money because power rates are up right now. Variable power rates. And I said, why is that? And he goes, well, because the biggest variable power rate is natural gas, and natural gas prices have quadrupled in the last 2 years. And so when we're selling power, we're competing with people that are using natural gas, you know, we can undercut them. And so Tacoma Power is making some pretty good money here lately. So that's hopefully it's going to keep your power rates low.
But, yeah. Yeah. Well, I love it. All of us here love it. I mean, we can all enjoy this beautiful, clean hydroelectricity we've got.
So let's think my more liberal, sometimes EV friends, they don't like what's called, I call the 90% solution, and that's plug-in hybrid. I've had a lot of my, especially older friends who have range anxiety or challenges, or maybe only one vehicle or have a home that can't do 20. I tell them, get a plug-in hybrid. So I got a lot of my friends that have Prius Prime. I have another guy has a BMW i5. There's one of the city council members in Ruston. She's got a RAV4 Prime. So to give an example, my friend Mark, he's got a Prius Prime. He's got 45,000 miles on it now, and he's on his 7th tank of gas.
Wow, that's awesome. Goes, yeah.
What? I go, yeah, he's averaging about 6,000 miles per tank full. And so what it is, and people understand, is that, you know, the first 30, 40 miles of your day, especially, you know, unless you're going on a trip, is all by electricity. And sometimes you do in the morning, you come home for lunch or do something else, plug in, and then you're back 30, 40 miles. And then if you get the plug in, or if you're going on a trip, then you become a gas vehicle.
Yeah, like, no, this
40,
is
50 miles of the gallon.
This is really a key point, because when people talk to me about buying an electric vehicle, and, you know, I have got my 2018 Leaf, they're right away, they're worried about range. What people don't realize is that 98% of their time, they're only going to be able to be driving 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 miles in a day. And just like your friend with the Prius there, they're doing almost all of it with the battery. And what I do, if I have to take a long trip, an over the highway long trip, I'll just rent a internal combustion engine car and do my trip with that. So there's all kinds of ways. So let's branch off on another topic a little bit here, and that is U.S. security in relationship to fossil fuels. So I think part of conservative philosophy is we want to be secure as a nation. And so how do you see fossil fuels and what we do for energy as relating to our national security?
I think it's critical. And that's where China, if you read some of their literature, they understand those countries that can secure their own energy and their own minerals are the countries that are going to lead the future. And that's where Europe right now is hurting, because they're relying on us now for, we export coal to Europe. We export natural gas to Europe. What I tell my friends is that 100 million barrels a day produced and consumed in the world. The good news is we're one of the largest producers, if not the largest, at 12, 13, 11, whatever that change, million barrels a day we produce. But the problem is we consume about 19. So we have a nexus, about 8 million barrels a day that we're importing. Well, I said, so that means we're exporting $800 million a day to countries that not all of them love us, or don't have our best interests in mind. And so I said, if you truly want to buy American first and be a energy independent and keep your dollars at home, you'll find ways to reduce your fossil. And so, and that's why we bought this new home 3 years ago. It had a gas water heater, and it was old, and I didn't know what condition it was in. And I said, just get rid of it. Let's get an electric one. So, you know, again, that was using my consumption of natural gas, and I had a natural gas dryer. I went with an electric dryer. We use a lot of electricity in this house, my house here, but that's another reason I'm getting solar power. Interesting about Steilacoom, and I'm going to get more data before I put it in my monthly newsletter. Here in Steilacoom, because we're a small utility, we get we have our own utilities, Town of Steilacoom Electric Company. Mm-hmm. We get our power from BPA, and we get a preferential allocation of very cost power. But we're at 98% of our allocation. So as people consume, like me with my electric vehicle and big house and all that kind of stuff, by me getting solar panel, I'm going to be actually producing enough electricity to cover my excesses. Not enough to cover my total consumption.
Right.
But that's another thing people understand. They said, oh, electric vehicles, how are we going to afford? They said, well, to be honest, I consume 28,000 kilowatt hours per year at this house. Two heat pumps. It's a big house, about 5,000 square feet. It's our expenditure in life. But my Leaf, I drive 10,000 miles a year. As you know, with a Leaf, I get about 4 miles per kilowatt hour. So I use about 2,500 kilowatt hours of the 28,000 for my car. So it's not even 10% of my electricity. This solar power is going to produce about 10,000 kilowatt hours. So I'll quadruple the amount on the car. But that keeps us under our allocation for the town. Once we go over our our allocation, then that new power is going to be much more expensive, which will then be averaged into the rates we set. A lot of people are really concerned about their electric rates, which so far promising and keeping to it, that we will raise them no rate faster than the rate of inflation. We'll see if we can hold to that. But, yeah. You know, I was talking to our electric company, and he says, we have like 400 or 500 transformers just in this little town of 2 square miles. He says, you know what the lead time on a new transformer is? 2 years.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So we're ordering, you know, fortunately we have a good supply of transformers, but they go out sometime.
Of course. So another thing I wanted to ask you about, you made reference early on, and I think I'm not out on a limb by saying, generally speaking, conservatives are skeptical about taxes. They would like to live in a lower tax environment. Sure. One of the ideas that's been floated around about reducing our fossil fuel consumption, and I would say in a way leveling the playing field some too, is to put a price on carbon. And a lot of those proposals also have a dividend or a cashback aspect to them. And there are conservative organizations that have proposed that. So what are your thoughts on that as a conservative?
Well, it's happening in this state coming 1 January. Very bad timing. So when they passed this law enacting the carbon tax and the low carbon fuel standard, which I'm totally against, but this carbon tax, which is actually going to be some of it spent in the road building, all that. When they did that in 2021, the average price of a gallon was $2 or something cents.
Yeah.
Also over $5. And this, by the way, this carbon tax goes into effect 1 January 2023. It's going to start at 15, 20 cents a gallon and work its way up to about $1 again. And so I think it's bad timing. I think politically it's going to mash your teeth, but in reality, it makes sense. I think even better than having a carbon tax, this was proposed in the 70s and 80s, was a oil input. So because we produce a lot of natural gas, you know, we export it. The process of exporting natural gas is not easy.
Right, yeah.
And so you have to liquefy it and put on special tankers, ship it and all that kind of stuff, but they still make a profit doing it. But we're net importers of oil, and if you want to inhibit importing of oil, then you would make an oil import fee. And there was a proposal to make it $10 a barrels like that. But it was interesting at the time when it was first proposed, you know, the guy who fought tooth and nail against it happening?
No.
Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts.
Okay.
Now, why would Senator Ted Kennedy be against that? Well, back in Massachusetts, a lot of people heat their houses with oil.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So, which I think is a shame that people would do that. But yeah.
Well, let's talk about with that national politics just a little bit. Fairly recently, there's been an organization, a caucus formed in the House of Representatives called the Conservative Climate Caucus. Are you paying attention to what those folks are doing and why they formed this group?
No, I haven't. I do belong to I'm on their newsletter type thing. It's
okay.
Called Secure America's Future Energy, SecureEnergy.org, I think it's the website. And it's all the board of directors is mainly headed up of retired 4-star admirals, general officers, and a couple of them that I know from the past to work for some of them. But their whole idea is all of the above is the idea that make America energy dependent. And when I talk to my conservative friends about that, they're all, the eyes just wide open. Oh yeah, now I fully understand what you're going for. I want us to be net and, you know, energy independent, and in some cases exporters of energy. I think the United States can do that by, again, number one is reducing our fossil fuels and even reducing our use of coal or using what I call some natural gas, because what we don't use, then we can export to the countries who really need it. I think Europe is going to eventually transition to, you know, a net zero, but it's going to take 30 years to do that.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to do that by Germany and other places. A lot of wind energy, but the baseline is going to be the nuclear. I think they need to, places where it makes sense, solar power. They're talking about in Spain and Portugal, where they have lots of sunshine, building these solar farms and having transmission lines going all the way up to the United Kingdom. It was actually cheaper to do that than to put solar power in London or something like that, you know, where they have the same climate we do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it makes good sense.
Solar power here in the state of Washington, especially in Western Washington, only makes sense as long as we don't have too much of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem is we produce a lot of solar in the summer, but where do we need our electricity? In the winter.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the solar power I'm going to produce is going to go on the grid. It's going to be sent probably to California or someplace else, whatever. We have an excess glut of electricity here in the state of Washington this summer because we don't have for heating. Rarely do we have a need for air conditioning, especially during January. Yeah. I had to turn the heat on the other day.
Yeah. Well, I've had my heat on this morning. And so I hate to admit that because I'm okay at 60 degrees in my house, but it was colder than that when I got up this morning. But I'm not going to lie. I love the cool weather. So, well, we're getting close to the end here, Dick. First off, I think that we have demonstrated that a liberal and a conservative can have a thoughtful conversation about the environment and climate change and those kind of things. And so do you folks out there that like to squabble rather than talk, pay attention here, because you can have an enjoyable, productive, and fruitful conversation. And one of the things I believe, too, is that you can't have a conversation with another person until you understand what it is that person's trying to say. Otherwise, it's just an argument. Sure. So yeah. I like to start off with understanding another person. We've discussed several areas that I think that we can all agree on: streamlining permitting processes, energy independence, pollution, minimizing pollution. There's lots of areas that we can certainly agree on. And so as we finish up here, Dick, anything else you'd like to say as we finish our day here?
I think everybody should consider at least one of their vehicles in their homes, if they have more than one, to be either all electric or at least a plug-in hybrid electric. And there's a plethora of new products coming onto the market. And if you want to see what they look like, come to my electric vehicle car show, my 9th annual electric vehicle car show. I can't believe that I started this 9 years ago and it's still going. But it's downtown Steilacoom, always the Saturday after Labor Day. The show is from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. And the beauty of the show is there will be no car dealers, nobody trying to sell you anything. You'll be talking to people who own these electric vehicles. We expect we'll have about 30 to 35 different model types. We already have 21 that are signed up and probably about 100 vehicles. We are going to have a Tesla meetup. And then for you, John, and a few others, I'm going to have a special after the show's over, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. I'm going to have a meetup at the downtown Steilacoom, the tap room. We'll have some refreshment and I'll supply the food. And we're going to have a roundtable discussion among political leaders and environmental about electric vehicles and other types.
I love the idea of the after brief there. And this will be my third year, I believe, attending the EV show there in Steilacoom myself. And my partner, Diane, will be there with her Mustang Mach-E, which is a really sweet car. And wow. I just want to congratulate you, Dick, on, I think you said, eight or nine of these shows. And
this will be my 9th one.
Ninth one. Okay. Well, they're grand events. And you also make the point, no dealers. And so it really means just a lot of ordinary folks sharing ideas and thoughts, and people that are considering buying an electric car, they can talk to somebody who's got no axe to grind.
Yeah. And we have people that even set up displays and all that kind of stuff. And two of my friends have done that in a year. And it's free. And there's a great, there's museums down there and there's the waterfront and, you know, and it's guaranteed good weather. It's, you know, September.
Well, you've got a great, great little town down there. And it's truly a town. It's not like some of these suburbs that aren't really towns. It's really a town. I always enjoy myself when I'm down there. And I believe that Steilacoom is lucky to have a guy who believes in good government and is doing a good job down there. Congratulations on your recent win electorally, too. So, Dick, thanks so much for being with us. I've really enjoyed the conversation and looking forward to September.
See you September 10th. Sounds good. Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much to Dick Murray for sharing his conservative viewpoint on climate, the environment, and electric vehicles. As a progressive, I have different opinions than does a conservative like Mr. Murray, but the simple truth is we aren't going to get to where we need to be climate or environment-wise without paying close attention to multiple voices, including conservatives. We can start by paying attention to places where our opinions overlap. Okay, and put it on your calendar, Drive Electric event in Steilacoom on September 10. You can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at cctacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. The CCL part is for Citizens Climate Lobby. I'm an activist with Citizens Climate Lobby. Check it out, a bunch of good people. Join up or find another organization if you aren't already attached. Join your voice with others. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under Programming. So until we talk again, remember that all great victories were almost great defeats. Always live like the mountain is out. Take care now.